since we last met. We had a new addition to the family. He's a boy, came in aged 22, weighing approximately 65 kilos. And Baruch Hashem, mother and father-in-law are both well. So we took a break last week, but the Parsha did not. So we have, in the meanwhile, had Parshas Miketz. So much has happened with Yosef and the brothers. They are in a state of absolute confoundment. And Binyamin was the one found with a cup. Yosef says he should stay, and they can all go home. At this point, Yehuda intercedes. And the opening pasuk, Peret Mem Dalet, pasuk Yudches, reads, Vayigash Elav Yehuda. Yehuda approaches. Vayomer Biyodinu says, "Please, my master, Yedaber No Abdecha Dover Ba'avnei Adoni. May your servant, may I speak something in your ear? Vayichar Abcha Ba'avdecha. Do not be angry with me. Ki Chamocha Kafaro, because like you, like Paro, you are like Paro." And the question is, what is the meaning of these words, kamocha kafaro? What does Yehuda mean to indicate or hope to achieve by equating Yosef with Paro? Interestingly, Rashi comments on these words, kamocha kafaro. He gives no less than four different interpretations, as far as I know. This is the only time Rashi has given four interpretations of something in the entire Torah. There's a few threes, quite a lot of twos, but here we have four different interpretations, and as Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky points out, there's no room, there's no need to exclude any of them, as is often the case, lahavdil, but as is often the case when one speaks, when a person of depth speaks an occasion which is significant, there are very often different overtones and undertones and primary messages and secondary messages and tertiary messages, and the whole thing blends together. Which means that whereas the pshat of kamocha kafaro is that you're choshev like Paro, you're as eminent as Paro, of course that's the pshat. But then you have the drash, you're a liar like Paro, I'll deal with you, then I'll deal with Paro. They're all true. Those are the subterranean messages. They're in the drash of the pasuk because they're in the drash of Yehuda's words. They're the more, one could say, subliminal messages, and Yosef needs to get all of them in order to get the whole message. And that's Rashi, as Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky discusses in a very wonderful manner. But a very interesting explanation of these words, ki chamocha kefaro, it is because of a big step, you know, bordering on flattery, which can sometimes be dangerous. To say that Yosef is like Paro, what difference does it make if he's like Paro, and what's it got to do with the case at hand? And the Ksav Sofer explains that Yehuda is about to ask for something which is technically unlawful, in the sense that Yosef has pronounced judgment, and Binyamin will stay with him, and the others can go home. Yehuda is looking to modify things, but to modify justice is unjust. To change a judge's verdict is not correct. But that's exactly what Yehuda is looking to do. Instead of him, take me, etc. and so forth. How can he hope that Yosef will grant his request? How can he, or whoever this Egyptian leader is in his understanding, how can he hope that he will even listen to it? He could get into trouble just for suggesting such a thing. He's asking effectively for a something which is not unjust. However, even within a justice system, says Ksav Sofer, there exists a concept which can override the normal channels of justice, and that is known as a royal pardon, whereby the king has the right, notwithstanding a verdict that has been reached by a judge, the king can overturn it and show clemency and show mercy. That's exactly what Yehuda is looking to achieve. He's saying, I know this is the verdict, and we pronounced our own verdict, and you've actually modified it. I'm looking to modify it further. How can I make so bold as to do such a thing? Because you're like Paro. In this respect, I put to you that you're like Paro, in the same way that Paro the king could issue a royal pardon, so too, that is what I'm looking for from you. So that's a very interesting, it's a direct and very elegant understanding of these words, kamocha kefaro. Interestingly, according to the Vilna Gaon, we do the same every year. Because on our Yom Hadin, on the day of Rosh Hashanah, which we've come to understand is the Yom Hadin, Yom HaZikaron, Zichron Trua, and we spend much of the day focusing on Malchius, on emphasizing the concept of royalty as we know. It's the dominant theme of the day. And based on the Vilna Gaon, many Mefarshim explain that we're effectively looking to do the same thing. As we know, it's the reality of life. Lo yitzdak lefanecha badin. If a person would try and withstand the full measure, the full force of Midas Hadin, they might not fare so well. And therefore we proclaim HaKadosh Baruch Hu King with the goal of securing a royal pardon. If this is the, so to speak, the annual coronation day, amnesties are available, pardons are available, and that is the one of the ways of understanding why we emphasize this on Rosh Hashanah. It's a very interesting approach. And that's, as we said, is like what Yehuda is doing. He's looking for this royal pardon, can only be given by a king, but Yosef is like Paro. Well, Yehuda continues and presents and recaps on the recent events until Yosef cannot take the pressure anymore, and finally he reveals his true identity as Yosef. And I'd like to focus on a pasuk with an attendant comment of Rashi. It's from Chazal, within the what we could call the revelation stage, and that is in Perek Memhei, pasuk Yudbeis. And here, Yosef says, "V'hine einechem ro'os, behold, your eyes see, ve'einei achi Binyamin, and the eyes of my brother Binyamin, kifi hamedaba eilechem, that my mouth is talking to you." As we can appreciate, those final words, kifi hamedaba eilechem, need interpretation. If they're looking at him, they can see that it's his mouth talking to them. What is the meaning of these words? Kifi hamedaba eilechem. And Rashi here comments. Where are we now? Kifi hamedaba eilechem belashon hakodesh. In lashon hakodesh, in other words, kifi hamedaba eilechem means I'm talking to you in your language. And this actually is the same explanation given by Unkelus. If we look in Unkelus, he says on the words, Kifi hamedaber alechem, arei belishonchon anam mimalel imchon. That in your language, I am speaking to you. And the simple understanding of what Yosef means to indicate here, but what difference does it make? Is it what language he's speaking to them? What is he looking to establish? But rather to further prove that he is Yosef. You can see, it's me, I'm talking to you in your language. That's proof that it's Yosef. We may ask, why does he need to prove that he's Yosef? If he's Yosef, he's Yosef. I mean, he said he's Yosef, but it's very interesting that he should then need to proceed and prove that he's Yosef. When a person says that they're them, it's them. However, the answer to this question, as Mefarshim point out, gives us a bit of an insight into the state of the brothers at this stage. In other words, they don't know anything about this person in front of them, except for one thing. So far, he seems to have gone out of his way to torment them and to make them miserable and confused and bewildered and traumatized. And therefore, what's the first thing he said to them was that you're spies. The next thing he says, you've got to bring your brother down. The next thing he says, there's a cup in Binyamin's sack, and then he's going to stay with them. So for some reason, which they cannot explain, he seems to have it in for them. Which means, when he says, I'm Yosef, the brothers are not sure that they're able to accept that. Because it's very possible that this is just round five of his tormenting them. It's quite possible that he knew Yosef because they sold Yosef down to Mitzrayim, which means they know that at a certain point Yosef was in Mitzrayim. This person is clearly very resourceful and very creative, and it's just the last thing he's doing before he absolutely destroys them is to claim that they're Yosef, and it's just another round of this tormenting process. And that's what the brothers, amazingly, do not react. I mean, the Pasuk says they couldn't answer him because they were startled, and they were startled in the sense that they were just not sure what to make of the whole situation. And that's why it will. Many things have to happen before we see any response on the part of the brothers whatsoever. The first thing is in Pasuk Gimel, in the beginning of Perek Mem Hey, he says that he's Yosef, and the brothers just do not know what to make of the whole thing. In Pasuk Hey to Pasuk Yud Aleph, those good half dozen psukim or so of Perek Mem Hey, he starts to comfort them. If we look at Pasuk Hey, Va'ata al te'atzvu, don't be sad. Don't be angry that you sold me here. It was all for the good. I've been taking care of Egypt. I'll be able to take care of you. It all works out for the best. Okay. So he's talking and comforting them and reassuring them. And still, the brothers don't say anything because they don't know what to do. Our Pasuk, he speaks to them in Lashon HaKodesh. Still nothing. Still no response from the brothers. They might be beginning to thaw, but they're not yet prepared to cross that threshold of believing that it's actually Yosef. Finally, in Pasuk Tesvav, it states, Vayinashek l'kol achav, he kisses his brothers, and as we've noted in the past, there's two types of kiss in the Torah. The word for a kiss is neshika, but the verb can be used in one of two ways. What's more common is the word vayishak, which we find quite often. And once in a while, we find vayinashek. What's the difference between vayishak and vayinashek? It's the same word. But as we know, these are two grammatical forms. Vayishak is the kal. Vayishak is the kal. It's the normal, it's the standard. Vayinashek is what's called the PL, which is a much more active or intensive. Like we would say, shavar is he broke, and shiber is he smashed. It's a much more intensive thing. And that's why most of the kisses in Torah are more regular or normal, and that's why it will say Vayishak. It's when families meet each other, from sons to fathers, etc. Once in a while, you have a very emotional kiss, and this here is a classic example, because Yosef and the brothers, they haven't seen each other for so long, and therefore this is one of the more unusual situations. That's why the Pasuk uses the more intensive Vayinashek. Incidentally, I believe this may be at least part of why Rashi explains back in Parshas Vayetze that when Lavan kissed Yaakov, he was actually searching for jewels in his mouth. The Pasuk says that he ran to him and he hugged him and he kissed him, and Rashi says, do not get carried away. This is Lavan. Remember, he ran to him because he says, where's his money? He didn't know. Eliphaz took the whole thing. Where's his money? So when he hugged him, he was patting him down. He was looking for money or credit card or something. But Yichabek lo, didn't find anything. And then he kissed him, he's looking for jewels. Why does Rashi say that? I mean, it could be that it's just like the standard. But there it says vayichabek lo vayinashek lo. That is absolutely out of place. You never met him before. Okay, family's family, but becholzot, the standard should have been vayishak lo, just like when families meet. Vayinashek lo means something else is going on here. He's mining for gold here. And that's where Rashi says there. But here, of course, it's a natural. Vayinashek lecho lechav, vayev galem. He cries. And finally, the second half of Pasuk Tes Vav, we've had 15 psukim of revelation and demonstration and verification and identification. And finally, va'acharechen dibru echav ito. The brothers finally can bring themselves to speak to him. It's him. And even here, interesting to point out, it says va'acharechen. And as we've noted many times in the past, there's two types of after. We've mentioned recently, there's achar kein and acharei kein. Achar kein, Rashi tells us, is samach, shortly after. Acharei kein, muflag, a long time after, which means there wasn't even an immediate response to this final stage. They just took their time, collected their thoughts, and then they realized it's him. Acharei kein, dibru echav ito. So that's a very interesting understanding of from the brothers' point of view of how they related to Yosef, and he, by the time he put them through so much, he actually had to convince them that it was really him. Okay. But Rishonim have a basic question. Coming back to the matter of speaking to them in Lashon HaKodesh, you see, it's me, I'm speaking your language. And Ramban raises the question, how is that a proof of anything? After all, they live in a neighboring country. And if he knows their language, it can be. Especially as he is a prominent leader of this neighboring country, it's quite prevalent and common that the leader of one country will know the languages of other countries. So it doesn't seem to be much of a proof. The leader in Israel can speak Arabic, or by now he speaks Russian. So then it's just because he knows. But what does it mean? And moreover, asks Ramban, we can see that it's not considered such an unusual thing for someone in Egypt to know their language. After all, how do they communicate with Yosef in the first place? Through an interpreter. Of course, Yosef doesn't want to speak to them direct for obvious reasons, so they communicate through an interpreter. Says Ramban, how does the interpreter know their language? The answer is because he knows languages. They didn't look suspiciously at the interpreter as if to say anyone who speaks their language is instantly suspect of being related to them. No, he's an Egyptian and he knows their language. So if the Melitz, if the interpreter didn't raise any suspicions because people know their language, so then when he knows the language, it doesn't seem to really demonstrate much. Where is the proof? Wherein lies the proof? That is the question raised by Ramban. An interesting shaila. We approach with the understanding, how could he possibly know their language unless he's Yosef? But it's actually quite possible, and other people did. A very interesting answer to this question is given by the Radak. Again, as we've mentioned, on Bereishis, we're treated to the perush of the Radak on the Chumash Bereishis. And Radak says that there was a proof here. The proof that he's Yosef by speaking to them in their language doesn't come from the fact that he knows their language. After all, he can know their language, he's a leader, he can be fluent in languages. That's not what it's about. Rather, says Radak, sometimes a person's voice or their cadence or intonation changes depending on the language that they're speaking. As if to say, the brothers should recognize Yosef by his voice. Except, until he speaks to them in their language, they will not have the opportunity to remember and connect him speaking now with the way that they remember him speaking. Because as long as he's been speaking in a different language, with all of the inflections, etc. and so forth, that he's learned in his new language, it's quite possible that they wouldn't recognize his voice. We find there are people, if they're a multilingual, if they speak English and Hebrew, when you speak to them in Hebrew, So you think they'd be born and bred in Israel. They sound like they fell off a sabbatry tree with the R's and everything. But then they start talking in English and they're from Brooklyn. And it's a whole different, it's the same person, but it's like two different people because the mouth works differently. And that says Radakiv. It's a wonderful point. He is proving to them that he's him by speaking to them in their language. Again, not by the fact that he knows their language, but by speaking in their language, they're able to recognize all of the way that he used to speak. And this may well be the pshat in the pasuk, because it says kifia medaber elechem. The words are, it's my mouth speaking. Rashi says he spoke to them in Lashon HaKodesh, but the pasuk doesn't talk about what language he's speaking. The pasuk talks about the fact that it's him. But how do the two go together? Because it's only by speaking in their language they were able to see that it's him, because they have the familiarity of him speaking to them in their language. So that's a very interesting approach of the Radak. Rabbi Yonasan Eibishus likewise says in one of his Sfarim exactly the same idea. However, the entire matter really needs to be opened up just a little bit more. Because if we refer back to the Ramban's questions, which are very striking sounding questions. Again, Ramban asked, Rashi explains that Kifi Hamadaba Eilecha means you can tell that it's me, I know your language, and therefore that's proof. It's proof that it must be me. And Ramban says, well, maybe he just knew their language. After all, the interpreter knows their language. But one of the great Mefarshei Rashi from the Acharonim, the Nachlas Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Selnik, actually expresses a wonderment on Ramban's questions here in light of a very well-known episode that is related in the Gemara that is about Yosef himself. The Gemara Maseches Sota in Daf Lamed Vav Amud Beis recounts how the night before Yosef got out of jail, and he's going to see Paro the next day, so the Malach Gavriel came to visit him, and effectively gave him a crash course in all the known languages at the time. The setup, as described by the Gemara, was that you had Paro, and there are 70 steps between you and Paro. And the more languages you knew, the more steps you were able to ascend. Most people probably stayed down quite near the bottom. How many languages would a person typically know? However, it was arranged that Yosef should be able to speak to Paro on an equal plane. And therefore, the Malach Gavriel came and he taught him all these languages. That is the Gemara's exposition of the pasuk in Tehillim. Eidus b'Yosef Samo, b'tzeizo el Eretz Mitzrayim, which is about Yosef. It's the Shir Shayom for Thursday. It's Yosef, b'tzeizo el Eretz Mitzrayim. Sfas lo yodati eshma. Sfas, all languages that I never knew before, all of a sudden, I can hear them. I can understand them. And thus it was that Paro speaks to Yosef, and Yosef answers him, and in each language he keeps on going up and up. It's very interesting that the amount of steps you were able to ascend was depending on your knowledge of languages. Apparently your knowledge of other disciplines wouldn't help you very much. I don't know if there were other sets of steps. It was all about language, fine. And he keeps on going, and Yosef keeps on answering until he finds himself right next to Paro. So he's 70 for 70. And then, says the Gemara, Yosef starts talking to Paro in Lashon HaKodesh. And Paro didn't understand. And this was a very awkward moment for Paro, because he's built his entire setup based on his knowledge of all the available languages. And Yosef knows all of them, but now he knows number 71. And Paro was feeling somewhat inferior. So he did the honorable thing and made Yosef swear that he would never tell anyone that Paro didn't know this language, which is called Lashon HaKodesh. Okay, that would in the end rebound on Paro. It would come back to him because in the beginning of next week's Parsha, as we know, Parsha's Vayechi, when Yaakov wants Yosef, I'll not take bury me in Mitzrayim, don't bury me in Mitzrayim, take me back home to Eretz Canaan. And Yosef says, he'll do it. And then Yaakov says, Hishavali, I want you to swear to me. Now that's, he doesn't take Yosef's word. But the Gemara explains that, of course, he trusts Yosef, but he doesn't trust Paro to let Yosef go. And therefore, he introduced the added element of Yosef taking a shavua that he would bury him in Canaan, because now Yosef has leverage with Paro. Indeed, when after Yaakov died, so Yosef goes to Paro, and his first words are, Avi hishbi'ani le'mor, my father made me take a shavua that I would bury him in Canaan. And that was actually a significant word for Paro, because it's about shavuas. So initially he said, I'd like to bury my father in Yaakov in Canaan. And Paro said, no, he's staying here. He's a national treasure. He's the best thing that ever happened to Egypt, is Yaakov. He just entered the country. This famine stopped. And Yosef said, but he made me take a shavua, so I'm bound by my oath. So Paro said, well, undo your oath. Well, that's what oaths are for being undone. Nullify it. Annul it. But Yosef says, well, I'm not sure that you want me to do that, because remember I took that other oath all those years ago that you don't know Lashon HaKodesh. And that's the point where Paro begrudgingly said, okay, an Egyptian's word is his oath is his bond. And that's why he reiterates this in his response to Yosef and says, go and bury your father, kasher hishbi'echa, as he made you swear. In other words, okay, once the shavua is in, one can only envisage Paro said the words, kasher hishbi'echa, through gritted teeth, because it was over the shavua. He can't have it both ways. And that's the whole discussion in the Gemara there. Which means that on the one hand, Rabban is saying it's very common that Yosef, it's to be expected even that Yosef would know their language. But we see that's not true, because even Paro doesn't know their language, and Rabban seems to be not factoring that in. I mean, that's a simple understanding of Rashi, that it's proof that he knows their language. It must be that he's Yosef, because you see that only Yosef knew the language, even Paro didn't know. Now, the Rabban did raise a question, and that is, what about the Melitz? What about the interpreter? He knows their language. How come Paro didn't get involved with him? I mean, there's going to be oaths all around. But says Nachlas Yaakov, if you look carefully at Rashi's discussion of this interpreter, who we happen to know as his son Menashe, but that's neither here nor there as far as the brothers are concerned, let us see Rashi's words carefully in last week's parsha, Perek Membeis, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. That's the point where the Pasuk says that they didn't realize that Yosef understood them, because the Melitz was in between them ferrying information. Perek Membeis, Pasuk Kaf Gimel. They're speaking openly in front of Yosef. They're saying, it's all our fault, we should have had Rachmanis on him, and Reuben says, no, I told you not to do it, and you didn't listen, and now it's coming back to haunt us. They're talking literally openly in front of Yosef. The Heim lo yadu, says Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Heim lo yadu, they don't know, ki shamea Yosef, that Yosef could understand them. Ki hameles benosom, because he's talking to them through an interpreter, so as far as they're concerned, he doesn't speak their language. That's why they felt so free to speak so openly in front of him. Rashi says, Ki hameletz beinosam. What do these words come to explain? The reason why they were convinced he doesn't speak their language is because he's always talking through a meletz, an interpreter. Ki kishahayu medabrim imo, when they would speak with him, haya hameletz beinayim. You had this interpreter between them. Hayodeya, who knew, loshon ivri, veloshon mitzri. He knew Hebrew, and he knew Egyptian. So, perfect. He's the interface. V'hayam meletz divrehem le'yosef v'divre Yosef lahem. And he would then ferry the words, l'chach hayu svarim she'en Yosef makib b'lashon ivri. They thought, I guess he doesn't know Hebrew. Says Nachlas Yaakov, you see, Rashi is very careful in his phraseology. He states that the Meilit knew Lashon Ivri and Lashon Mitzri, Hebrew and Egyptian. And the Meilit obviously knows both of them, but for some reason they think Yosef doesn't know it. But that's about knowing Hebrew, or what we would call, what Rashi calls Lashon Ivri, which we might translate as Hebrew. Here, when Rashi says, you can see that it's me because I'm speaking your language, he doesn't say I'm speaking to you in Lashon Ivri. He says I'm speaking to you in Lashon HaKodesh. And Lashon Ivri and Lashon HaKodesh are not the same thing. And Rashi in each place is very specific, which means, as per Ramban's question, how could the Meilit speak their language? He didn't speak their language, not their specific language. He spoke a more general dialect called Lashon Ivri. Many people spoke that in Eretz HaIvrim, so to see. For some reason, Yosef didn't. They don't know why. It's not really their problem. But no one has spoken yet about Lashon HaKodesh. That's something that even Parah doesn't know. That's something that they've never heard the Meilit speak. It's the first time anyone speaks in Lashon HaKodesh, that's Yosef. And therefore, says Nachlas Yaakov, that's why it really is proof that it's Yosef. And really the point that the Nachlas Yaakov is putting out, which is fascinating to consider, is that we might typically run these two together and think there's two ways of referring to the same language, but they're not. Lashon Ivri Lechud and Lashon HaKodesh Lechud, and never the twain shall meet. And people may have known Lashon Ivri, no one knew Lashon HaKodesh except for Yosef and the brothers. So that's a very interesting response to Ramban's question, asserting the simple understanding of what Rashi means to say, that his knowledge of Lashon HaKodesh was a proof. However, the matter does go further. The Chasam Sofer discusses this whole Gemara, Paro doesn't know Lashon HaKodesh, and only Yosef knows, and he made him swear. The Chasam Sofer, in one of his drushes, actually it's a drusha for Asara B'Tavis. And Ramban and Chasam Sofer raises a simple question on the Gemara. The setup, as we recall, was Yosef knows all the languages, and then he knows another language, and Paro doesn't know it. It's a source of terrible embarrassment for Paro, and therefore he binds Yosef by an oath, swears him to secrecy. As Chasam Sofer, couldn't there be a better solution for Paro? Couldn't there be an easier way out? Namely, ask Yosef to teach you Lashon HaKodesh. I mean, you're effectively unemployed for the next 7 years anyway, because he's taken over the country. So you can arrange to have an ulpan with him 3 times a week. And hopefully by year 3 or 4, you should get the hang of it. And that the reason why that would be preferable is because then Yosef no longer has any leverage. If someone has something that you don't have, instead of just keeping it in almost in this petrified state where you make them swear that they won't tell anyone, which you hope they will honor, and of course he assumes that Yosef will honor his word, but why keep him with something, holding something over you like that? Take what he has, your paro, he can't say no, make him teach you Lashon HaKodesh, and then add a step, And you'll be 71 for 71, just like him. Why did Paro never ask Yosef to teach him Lashon HaKodesh? It's a very interesting shaila. And the answer of the Chasam Sofer is deserving of much reflection. And that is, says Chasam Sofer, Lashon HaKodesh is not just a language that you can learn the words. Lashon HaKodesh is a way of using Hebrew in the way the Torah does, almost, as if to say, in a way that is multi-layered and compacts maximum meaning into minimum space in a way that could almost be darshaned. That's called Lashon HaKodesh. It's called Lashon HaKodesh for a reason. In other words, Paro realizes that Yosef is speaking in a way where he is effectively communicating, or using language to communicate in a higher level. But that means that you can only do that if you're on a higher level. The way the Chasam Sofer puts it is, to speak Lashon HaKodesh in the full sense of the word, you need Ruach HaKodesh. You need a measure of inspiration and elevation that you are worthy of using Lashon HaKodesh in that way. Paro knows enough to know that it's effectively a different language, but he also knows he will never be able to learn it. You can't teach it unless you reach that level. Paro has no aspirations to reach any levels of Kedusha, and therefore his only option is to swear Yosef to secrecy. And if this is so, then it seems that Lashon HaKodesh and Lashon Ivri, if we take the Nachlas Yaakov's approach, which they're two separate languages, they may be two separate languages, but they might be, to borrow the expression, divided by a common language. In other words, it could be that Lashon Ivri really is what we call Hebrew, because to learn Hebrew, you just need a number of sessions. That anyone can learn Hebrew on a functional level. But Lashon HaKodesh is using Hebrew words in a way that is so more elevated than the common usage of the words. That makes it effectively a different language. And the reason why the Chasam Sofer talks about this in his drasha there for the Asara B'Teves is because he refers to the 3 days of tragedy that take place on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of Teves, which we refer to in the Slichos. We focus on the 10th of Teves, which is when the siege began of Yerushalayim. But already on the 8th of Teves, you had, in the days of Talmai, the Talmai II, the translation of the Torah into Greek. That was one of the earlier stages of the Greek presence, when we were owned by Egypt, not yet by Syria. And the Medrash refers to, really in tragic terms, to the translation of Torah into Greek, what's known as the Septuaginta, and says that the darkness descended on the world for 3 days. I mean, it was an absolutely tragic event. And the question is why? Especially as we know that the Torah, when we entered Eretz Yisrael, was translated into all 70 languages. Ba'er Heitev, Rashi says, B'shivim Loshon. So translating the Torah into another language doesn't seem to be such a tragedy. But here, the Medrash talks about it as if it was like the worst thing that ever happened, and darkness descended upon the world. But why? But the answer is, says Chasam Sofer, one thing is for sure. It could be that any language that you translate the Torah into will get something of the Torah's message. It won't be nothing. It will catch something. But there's no question that it will not catch everything. Right? So much will be lost. There's so much. How can you darshan any other language the way that you darshan the chaseiros and yeseiros and the syntax and the whole way that the Chumash is constructed? You can't. If there's ever a concept of lost in translation, it's the translation of the Torah to another language. So if it is for the benefit of those nations, so each nation can receive the Torah in their language, and they receive those aspects of the Torah that perhaps are of meaning to them. The whole Torah is not for everyone, it's for the Jewish people. The real tragedy of translating the Torah into Greek was that it would then lead to the Jewish people from that point onwards pursuing their Torah studies in Greek and not in Lashon HaKodesh anymore. And that is that those are 3 days of darkness, because there's no way that any other language can put together what the Torah has in Lashon HaKodesh. And for this reason, Chasam Sofer says, and it's a very, one could say, quite a staunch stance with regards to Lashon HaKodesh, his definition of Lashon HaKodesh is not Hebrew. His definition of Lashon HaKodesh is any word that is in Tanakh. That's called Lashon HaKodesh. Any word that is added post-Tanakh is not Lashon HaKodesh, even if it's Hebrew. And that's very interesting, because Chazal themselves make use of words which then became Hebraicized, but they're not in Lashon HaKodesh. They're not in the Tanakh, and therefore they're not Lashon HaKodesh. That means that there's words in the Mishnah, for example, Sanhedrin, which is from Sanhedrin, etc. and so forth. There's many, many examples. Chasam Sofer says Sanhedrin may now be a Hebrew word, but it's not part of Lashon HaKodesh. And that is all the more true with regards to to other words as Hebrew goes on and it grows, so to speak, and adopts words from other languages. So Hebrew may be growing, but Lashon HaKodesh is always remains the words in Lashon HaKodesh. I think it's reached a stage nowadays where it's very easy, if you're an English speaker, it's very easy to learn Hebrew. If you have a good English vocabulary, you have half of a good Hebrew vocabulary instantly. And once again, whereas that what one could say that's a value, but it's always we mentioned every once in a while when one speaks Hebrew, one fulfills the mitzvah. When one speaks modern Hebrew, one fulfills a mitzvah. It's the mitzvah of Havdalah, because there's a mitzvah to be mavdil ben kodesh lachol. As we've seen so often, there's nuances that didn't make it into modern Hebrew. They stay within the original Lashon HaKodesh, and therefore it has its function, but it shouldn't be confused, because then we lose out. So this is all b'malas Lashon HaKodesh. It's very interesting. Just recall the Orsamech, Rebbe Simcha Devinsk, who was very involved in the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael in the late 1800s, early 1900s for sure. And there's a famous letter from him. Someone wrote to him and asked him, what do you make of the whole nascent movement towards going back to Eretz Yisrael? In many respects, it was very encouraging, as is known. Well, it's not black and white. But and we have his letter. And he says a very interesting thing in the letter, because he refers to a medrash in the Sifrei in Parshas Ekev, which states that if a person lives in Eretz Yisrael and speaks Lashon HaKodesh, he's a Ben Olam Haba. So it's very easy to look at that medrash, especially if you live in Israel, and be very encouraged by it, because it doesn't sound too hard at all. You live in Israel, speak Lashon HaKodesh, and you're set. But everything changes when you see how Rav Meir Simcha talks about that medrash. He states that on the one hand, to live in Eretz Yisrael is a great opportunity that has now become available, but it's also a great responsibility. When a person lives in Eretz Yisrael, there are certain demands that are of them. They're in the Holy Land, and that really demands an elevation of them. Halo tireh! Consider, says Rav Meir Simcha, Omrom Zal. What did they say in the Medrash? That if you live in Eretz Yisrael and speak Lashon HaKodesh, you're a Ben Olam Haba. That means if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you are expected to reach a level that you can speak Lashon HaKodesh. All of a sudden, it doesn't sound so easy anymore, because the Orsameach is effectively echoing the sentiments of the Chasam Sofer. Lashon HaKodesh is not something that could be learned in an ulpan. Lashon HaKodesh is a way of speaking that reflects an elevation of being. And that's what's expected of a person if he lives in Eretz Yisrael. Says the Orsameach, that's the challenge of living in Eretz Yisrael. So it's a different perspective altogether. However, I think it's fair, just as a counterpoint almost, that to mention something that is it's described in the biography of Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, that's al Ha'ish al Chuma. And as we know, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, he was the head of the Eidah Haredes, leader of the Eidah Haredes, and there was staunchly opposed to secular Zionism, and there was much confrontation there, B'sochei Yerushalayim and beyond. And someone was once speaking to Rav Sonnenfeld about Eliezer ben Yehuda. And he spoke about ben Yehuda in very disparaging terms, castigating terms. And the feeling is that he thought that he would perhaps garner favor with Rav Soloveitchik, with Rav Sonnenfeld, by speaking in this way, because he knew how opposed Rav Sonnenfeld was to that approach, to the almost like deification of the Hebrew language for itself, with the exclusion of everything else. But much to his surprise, Rav Sonnenfeld took exception to him talking about Ben Yehuda in that way, for two reasons. Firstly, says Rav Sonnenfeld, he's Jewish, and you never talk about a Jew in the way that you just did. That's number one. And here's Rav Sonnenfeld reminding us that there's a concept called machlokas l'shem shamayim, whereby you can have fierce opposition, and he had, on an ideological level, it can never devolve to any acrimony on a personal level. And there are many, many stories and episodes where Rav Sonnenfeld showed great concern, even for his his fiercest opponents on a personal level, they're his fellow Jews. But it's about ideology, that's where it comes from. But as for a Jew, you can never talk about a Jew that way. And secondly, says Rav Sonnenfeld, do you think it's a small thing that he effectively revived the Hebrew language? Consider, from this point onwards, anyone who speaks Hebrew has a way into Torah in a way that they never would have otherwise. The Torah would have been a closed book to them. If they don't speak Hebrew, if they don't converse in Hebrew, it's a closed book to them. But now it's open. They need to transition. They'll need to appreciate it, but the door is open for them. Says Rav Sonnenfeld, I object to much of what he's doing, but that's a schus, and you can't take it away from him. Those are Rav Sonnenfeld's words. And it's interesting to note, just in parting, as you know, Rav Sonnenfeld is the Eda Charedis, their reaction to the whole revival of the Hebrew language was actually to refuse to speak it. They spoke Yiddish, they conversed in Yiddish, they taught in Yiddish, and effectively they were reacting to what they felt was, again, the glorification of Hebrew as a substitute, chas v'chalila, for Judaism, which many people saw that's what it should be. But on one occasion, Rav Sonnenfeld remarked to one of his confidants, to one of his talmidim, he said, we made a mistake. We, the Yishuv HaYashan, we made a mistake. The mistake was that we let the secularists revive Hebrew first. At which point we had no choice but to react to it. If we'd have been more alert, we would have done it first, and then this whole thing would have been unnecessary. But there's nothing wrong with Hebrew. What was done to it, we take exception to. So we should have done it first. Those were his words. A great deal to think about. And again, it all comes from this Rashi, or spawned our discussion from this Rashi, Kipiha Medaber Aleichem, Lashon HaKodesh, Lashon Ivri, what lies between them and what they have in common. Well, let's just conclude the Shir this evening by referring to Yaakov's descent to Mitzrayim. And that is in the end of Perek Mem Hei. The end of Perek Mem Hei. And they tell Yosef, or Od Yosef Chai, this is in Pasuk Kaf Vav. And firstly, Yaakov can't believe it. If the brothers couldn't believe it, Yaakov certainly doesn't believe it. It's the first he's heard of all this. But in the end, of course, he sees that it's true. His spirit is revived. Pasuk Kavches. Vayomer Yisrael. He's Yisrael now. Gone from Yaakov to Yisrael, completely uplifted. Rav, this is a great thing. Od Yosef ben Ichai, my son Yosef is alive. El Chaber Enu Beter Mamus. I will go and see him. I must go and see him before I die. And so he does. In the beginning of Perek Mem Vav, Vayisa Yisrael b'chol ha-shelo, he travels, everything with him, Vayavo be'er ha-shav, he comes to Be'er Sheva, Vayizbach zavochim lelokei aviv Yitzchak, and he offers korbanos to the God of his father, Yitzchak. And of course, immediately what strikes us is that Hashem is Elokei aviv Yitzchak, but he's also Elokei aviv Avram. So why do we have this selective relationship where Hashem is referred to him exclusively as Elokei Aviv Yitzchak? And Rashi comments on this. It's a famous comment of Rashi, and that is, Chayav Adam Michvot Aviv. You see from here that a person is liable to honor his father, Yosef Michvot Zikno, more than he's liable to obligated to honor his grandfather. Lefichav Tala B'Yitzchak Below B'Avraham. That's why it mentions Yitzchak and not Avraham. The question remains, and again, we've discussed the Rashi in the past and need to discuss it again in the future, why does this come out here? In other words, we've already seen that Yaakov is refers to Hashem as Elokei Avi Avraham, Elokei Avi Yitzchak. He refers to both of them, and one understands exactly how they're related to each other. Why at this late stage, of all places, does it come out here that a person is chayav to honor his father more than his grandfather? What's it got to do with the korbanos that are being offered here? Which is a good question that needs to be left for when we come around to discuss the Rashi. But what is interesting is, the pasuk says that he offered korbanos to Hashem, the God of his father Yitzchak, And then in Pasuk Gimel, when Hashem appears to him, he seems to resonate with that. Vayomer Anochi Hakel Elokei Avicha. I'm the God of your father, which seems to endorse effectively what Yaakov did, because Hashem also mentions only his father. It doesn't say Elokei Avosecha, etc. and so forth. But why is this so? And there are two classic approaches to different than Rashi into these psukim. And the first is the Sephorno, and the Sephorno actually takes us back to the concluding words of Perik Memhei, the pasuk with which we started, pasuk Kavches, when he says, "Rav Od Yosef ben Yichai, elcha ve'erenu b'terem amos." I'll go and see him before I die. And the Sephorno, he doesn't, as he never does here, he never speaks at length and to discuss exactly what the issues are. But when you think about it, that is a very, very understated and modest, I would say, expression of for Yaakov, just now discovering that Yosef is alive. After 22 years, and Yosef is finally alive. And what does Yaakov say? I should probably go and see him sometime. El chaverenu, I'll go and see him before I die, hopefully sometime. I mean, that's it. And the Sephorno says, yes, that's it. Meaning, Yaakov at that stage was not expecting that he would ever do more than go and see Yosef. And even that was a big gesture. Why? Because he's back in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, he's born in Eretz Yisrael. He's had to run for his life once from Esav, and he was away for a long time. But now he's back. It's not Pikuach Nefesh anymore. It's very nice. One cannot describe his feelings upon hearing that Yosef is alive. But Yosef is in Chutz Laretz. So maybe a trip. But then I'm back. I'm not going to live there. And if he can't come and live here, that's too bad. But I'm here in Eretz Yisrael. Because he understood, which of course in principle is rightly so, that the place of the Jewish people is in Eretz Yisrael. And if it's not Pikuach Nefesh, like Yitzchak, he shouldn't have to leave. And that's why he takes a stopover almost on the way to Mitzrayim, and he offers these korbanos. And what are the korbanos about? Because he's looking to commune with HaKadosh Baruch Hu about whether he's even allowed to make this trip. And that's why it says, Vayizbach Sevachim, he offered korbanos in order to connect with Hashem, and he connects with Hashem, Lelokei Aviv Yitzchak, the God of his father Yitzchak. Why is Yitzchak the only one mentioned here, and not Avram? Because Yitzchak never left Eretz Yisrael, and Yaakov is anticipating that he will receive similar instructions. He's expecting that Hashem may tell him, you can't go. Am I like Yitzchak? If I'm like Yitzchak, I can't go. Yitzchak can't leave Eretz Yisrael, maybe I can't leave. It's not Pikuach Nefesh. That's why Yitzchak is mentioned, because he understands that he anticipates that he's in a Yitzchak frame. Interestingly, Hashem says, responds by Yomer in Pasuk Gimel again, Anochi Akel Elokei Avicha, I am the God of your father Yitzchak. Meaning, in principle, you do have that relationship, but you know what? It's time to go. Al tira midar mitzrayma. At this point, Yaakov was informed, not only did he have permission to take a trip to Eretz Mitzrayim, he's actually being told that he needs to go down there to live. And that's where we become a great nation, and Hashem will decide when to bring him up. Interestingly, it's a parenthetical comment, but it's a wonderful thing that we find in Pasuk Hey, after having been told that he can go to live in Mitzrayim, that he's meant to go and live in Mitzrayim. Vayakam Yaakov in Be'er Sheva. So he arrives from Be'er Sheva. Vayisru b'nei Yisrael. Es Yaakov aviem. They take Yaakov. Es tapam es l'shem. Ba'agalos asher shalach paro laseis oso. In the wagons that Paro had sent to take them. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, Slobodka Rosh Yeshiva, he asked an interesting question. Why are these wagons only mentioned here when they're going from Be'er Sheva to Mitzrayim? How did they get to Be'er Sheva in the first place? They've already traveled from home, as it says in the beginning of the parak, by Yisa Yisrael v'chola shelo v'yevo Be'er Sheva. How did they get to Be'er Sheva? Presumably with the same wagons. So how come the wagons are only mentioned here? But the Rebbe Epstein says no. It's a litvish and a very Ehrlich explanation here. But that is, Yaakov didn't want to use the wagons at that early stage, because he wasn't sure if he's allowed to go down to Mitzrayim. Those wagons were sent to take him down to Mitzrayim. He thought he's not going until he gets permission, so he's not able to. He's not allowed to accommodate Paro's plans. But if you can't accommodate his plans, you can't use the wagons that he sent you. They weren't sent for your own personal use. They're sent to take you down to Mitzrayim until he knows he can go down to Mitzrayim. So he walks the wagons. He makes his own provisions. It's only once Hashem says, you're going down to Mitzrayim. Oh, I'm going down to Mitzrayim. I've been sent wagons for that purpose. And then the agolos are mentioned in Pasuk Hei. So that is the Sforno's approach. Very, very interesting. It's insights into Yaakov's expectations at this time. Originally, he was hesitant even to take a temporary trip. Tel Hashem informed him otherwise that he'd actually be going there for a good while longer. Another explanation in this matter is from another of the early Acharonim, Rabbi Shlomo Ishtaruk is his name. The Chidah quotes him quite often. And he also addresses the exclusive focus on Hashem as the God of Yitzchak. Why is that so? And he says, and again, it's to bring us into the, at least to the extent that we can, an aspect of the of the consciousness of you know, at this time of Yaakov. From the time of Avram, everyone is living under the expectation or the forecast of the Bris Ben Abisarim, which was said that Ger Yazarach, as we know, Be'eretz Lo Lahem, there'll be strangers in a land which is not theirs. Va'avodah Ve'inosam, they'll be enslaved, they'll be persecuted. Now, this didn't all happen at once. The notion of being somewhat alien, treated as a stranger, happened by itself. Stage one. As soon as Yitzhak was born, everything changes. Yitzhak is never really accepted in the way that Avram was. Which means so far, if we could frame this time in terms of the Bris Ben Abisarim, they're at stage one of Bris Ben Abisarim, and stage two is pending. They're at the stage of Ger Yezarecha, but there hasn't been Va'avodim Ve'inu of some. No one's enslaved them. No one's persecuted them. They had a couple of run-ins, but no persecution. But we understand that everyone is anticipating that at a certain stage things will escalate, and no one knows when. And not only is this true in Yaakov's time, it's true even in Yitzchak's time. If we find an interesting thing in Pasuk Kafvav, Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Tetzayin, if we go back and again just see the sweep of Chumash Bereishis in this way, gives us a great insight. Perek Kafvav, Pasuk Tetzayin. Oh, sorry, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, pardon me. Oh, Perek Kafav, Pasuk Kaf Dalet. So, what do we have here? Yitzhak has had his, again, run-ins with Avimelech. Vayiroi lav Hashem balayla ahu. Hashem appears to him in Vayom and says, Anochi Elokei Avram Avich, I'm the God of your father Avram. Al tira, do not be afraid. Ki itcha Anochi, I'll be with you. Don't be afraid. And Rav Eshteruk asks, afraid of what? What should he be afraid of? I mean, okay, he's had a bit of trouble, but what's the fear? The fear is that he is already transitioning from just being a ger to Vavodim Ve'inu Osam, because this is the first trouble that he's had. It's low level at this stage. He's digging wells, they're filling in his wells, they banished him from, expelled him from that area, etc. This is the first, in a sense, antagonism that he's experienced. And everyone knows at a certain point it will go from being Ger Yezarecha to Vavon Ve'inu Osam. And Yitzhak was apprehensive that that's already happening. And that's why at that stage HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to Yitzhak and says, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid, meaning this is trouble, but it's not what you're thinking. It's not Va'avodim Ve'inu Osam. That won't happen for a long time. And Rav Eshteruk says, if we fast forward to our parsha, we see that Yaakov, again, we're on a threshold of a transition, and who knows what it will bring, and who knows what it might bring soon, because he's being ejected from Eretz Yisrael, seemingly by force of circumstance, moving towards Mitzrayim, And who knows what's waiting for him there. And it's the same apprehension that Yitzchak had. And that's why the Pasuk says he offers korbanos l'elokei aviv Yitzchak, as if to say, am I like Yitzchak? Me, or am I different? Am I like Yitzchak in that you reassured him? Or maybe no, maybe we're already transitioning. And that's why Hashem said, Anuchi akel elokei avicha, I am the God of your father, meaning I am relating to you in the way that I related to him. I kept him from experiencing stage two of Avodah Inosam, and I will keep you from it as well. Do not be afraid to go down there. You'll become a great nation. Things will transition, but not in your lifetime. That will already happen after the passing of Yaakov, and that's the beginning of Vayechi, Nistimu Ineim, V'libam Shel Yisrael, with the passing of Yaakov, and those are the events as they continue to unfold in next week's Parsha, but we'll leave it over there for now.